Hey, this is Michael Rosenbaum, Lex Luthor from Smallville, and you're listening to Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life.
Hello, comic book aficionados. Welcome to Comic Book Central. I'm your host, Joe Stuber, here in the Comic Book Central lair. Thanks for stopping by. I hope you enjoyed the premiere episode with my special guest, Stan Lee, and from the looks of it, many of you did. I'll be honest, I'm completely overwhelmed by the reaction to the show. I had no idea so many of you would be downloading, listening, and sharing it. You hope for those things, but you never know how these things are going to turn out, so very much appreciated. There are people liking the Facebook page, sharing the links, retweeting the posts, promoting it on their podcast. Man, if I had a budget, I'd put you all on my marketing team right now. And, you know, from the comments I'm seeing, you folks are digging the show, which is pretty sweet. So, not unlike an arrow shot from Green Arrow's bow, you listeners got me right in the heart. Truly grateful for everything you're doing to get the show out there. So, keep on keeping on with getting the word out. I'll do my best to keep bringing some cool guests into the lair for a chat. All right, enough of this crazy love fest. We've got a show to get to. Let's get right to it. Earlier, I mentioned the premiere episode of Comic Book Central, and one of the listeners, Jeremy Lamastis, dropped me a line on Facebook, and he asked about the book I referenced with Stan Lee. That was the book that mentioned some of the aborted Marvel movie projects from a ways back. Well, the book is called Marvel Comics, The Untold Story, and it's written by Sean Howe, and it is an incredible read, a true page-turner. There's a lot of stories you've never heard about Marvel Comics in there, so go pick up a copy, Marvel Comics, The Untold Story by Sean Howe. You'll be glad you picked it up. Now on to today's episode. This is a very special time here in Comic Book Central. For the next few episodes, we're going to be celebrating the 75th anniversary of the first appearance of the Man of Steel. That's right, Kal-El, the last son of Krypton, the Man of Tomorrow. It's a celebration of Superman. I've got some guests lined up from several live-action takes on the Superman mythology, from Superman the movie, Lois and Clark, The New Adventures of Superman, and, of course, today's guest, Michael Rosenbaum, who played Lex Luthor in the television series Smallville. Check this out, and I'll be right back with Michael Rosenbaum. In 1938, two brilliant young men from Cleveland, Ohio, writer Jerry Siegel and artist Joe Shuster, gave the world their most iconic creation, Superman. Action Comics number one hit the newsstands with a bang, turning comic books into big business and ushering in the age of the superhero. Over three quarters of a century, Superman has been adapted into just about every media outlet you can imagine. Newspaper comic strips, books, radio and television shows, Broadway and film. One of the most successful adaptations was the television show Smallville. For 10 seasons starting in 2001, fans of the show were treated to a retelling of the Superman origin that brought in many classic elements of the mythology and created many new ones. Tom Welling played young Clark Kent, who, for the most part, stayed grounded while he adapted to his newfound strength and agility. Clark's counterpart on the show was Lex Luthor. But this wasn't the evil Lex Luthor we'd come to know over the years. On Smallville, Clark and Lex were friends, and viewers got a chance to see how the animosity between the two developed. Lex was played by Michael Rosenbaum, a brilliant young actor who brought equal parts of mystery and menace to the role. In the closing moments of a first-season episode, Rosenbaum's Luthor set the stage for the Superman-Lex story we all know and love.
Trust me, Clark. Our friendship is going to be the stuff of legend.
Well, our guest today, he is a quadruple threat. Actor, director, writer, producer. He's portrayed a legendary hero, and he's portrayed what some have called the most sinister villain of all time. A big welcome to Michael Rosenbaum. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thank you. You forgot to mention voiceover actor.
Well, I count that as actor. I mean, they're actors.
I'm kidding. Come on.
You say that, and then all of a sudden, voiceover actors are like, there's no differentiation between it. So, you know what? It's...
You know, I do a lot of things. It sounds like I do a lot, but, you know, I'm always okay to good at a lot of things, but never great at one thing.
Jack of all trades?
I like to do so many things. I think it's because I have ADD.
Hey, lay some odds for us here. What are the chances we're going to see you with a shaved head on the big screen in 2015?
On a scale from zero to horseshit. Are we allowed to say that on the air?
You just did, so that's okay.
You can bleep that out. You have the technology.
I do. We do have the technology to do that.
You know what? I would, look, I, of course, would love it. I think it'd be a lot of fun. I think I could play the character. You know, unfortunately, you know, I mean, look, you never know, but, you know, they try to go for the big movie stars, and, you know, and a lot of times they think, oh, well, you know, he was the TV Lex Luthor. We don't want to, we can't cross. Do I sound a little bit disturbed by that? Maybe. I think it's, you know, a little bit annoying, but, you know, I think if people like you playing a part, I don't see why you can't continue playing that part.
Well, I think your Twitter feed, I think you admit, I think you said it best on your Twitter feed. You said, can the Superman fans out there spread the word that there's really no other choice? Let Cranston, let Cranston stick to meth. Thanks. And you had the little thanks at the end, too, which I thought was very polite.
Well, you see, a lot of people, I think the bright people in the world, or the Twitter followers, were thinking he's joking, he's kidding around. I'm a joker. I like to kid around. But I was saying, my point was, Cranston is like a huge success. His show's tremendous. He's a great actor. Let him stick to meth. Let him stick to, he's got enough work. That was kind of the joke. But then, of course, it spread like wildfire, and I was like, oh, my God, this thing went viral. And then you get the guys on their, you know, their talk shows that are like, isn't this the same guy who left Smallville? I'm like, wait a minute, I didn't leave Smallville. My contract was 6 years. I did seven. How is that leaving? So,
well, and the show itself lasted 10 years. So, if you're going by success of television, you had quite a successful show, and you were in the mind of the character for 7 years.
Oh yeah, and I came back at the end, and so.
Do you know Affleck?
Say what they want. What's that?
Do you know Affleck?
I know the insurance.
You know the doc.
Affleck.
You're friends with the doc.
That was a bad joke, my friend Joe. But let me. I don't know him, but I do admire him. I think he's. He's a real talent. I think he's, I certainly loved Argo. Who didn't? I think he's, this is a guy who, you know, has been around for a long, long time, and he stood the test of time, and I really respect that, and I think he's a really good actor, and I think he's a real talent, so, yeah.
Do you know Snyder?
You know, I don't know Zack Snyder. I was supposed to, back in the day, not to plug the name of the movie that I directed that's coming out in January, called Back in the Day.
Plug but, away, and we'll talk about it, too.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I was supposed to audition for Dawn of the Dead that he directed a long time ago, and I was out of town, and I couldn't do it. And then I became friends with James Gunn, who wrote that, but that didn't happen until after. So I always wonder what could have happened. But that's one of my favorite movies, Dawn of the Dead, the remake. And I don't know Zach, but I'm a big fan. Big fan. I mean, I watch all his movies. I think he's a real innovator. And I'm not kissing either. I actually like him. If you said some other directors, I'd be happy to say no, I don't like them. But he's one I do like.
Well, I'm pulling for you because I think you got in the head of the character like nobody else did. You certainly spent enough time with him. So to me, that's the mark of what you want from an actor who knows the
character.
Well,
you know, I appreciate that. I ultimately just wanted to play the character real and have a sense of vulnerability. And just, you know, I wanted to bring reality to the character and to the show. And I just didn't want it to be bubblegum and, you know, I love the depth. I think if you see some of those episodes where I go a little crazy, or, you know, my father obviously influences that.
Just a little bit.
But you'll see. I mean, I like to explore. I like to get deep. And a lot of times in these movies or even in television, you don't get to do that. But, you know, definitely if they're looking for depth, I hope they consider me at least.
One of your first roles was in Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil. What did you learn from Clint Eastwood?
You know, I had such respect for the guy that it's not that he demands it, he's just earned that respect. And I think, you know, you should always come prepared to work. And I think that's what he, you know, inadvertently demands. I think it's like you come to work knowing what you're supposed to do. And he hires actors that can just come in and do the job. So his work is done. He sets up the camera. He looks at you. He doesn't say action. I mean, I know that you know, I guess it's folklore, but it's not.
Yeah, he just, really like, says go, right?
I remember I'm sitting on this park bench in the scene that eventually was cut. Unfortunately, it was me and John Cusack. But it was like the first scene that I had ever done in a movie, I believe. And, you know, it's Clint Eastwood directing me. John Cusack's right there. And I'm sitting on a park bench, and I'm supposed to really cry. It's like this post courtroom scene. It was really, really emotional, and I'm sitting there. I'm supposed to be crying, and Clint sees that I'm listening to my headphones, and I'm listening to like Fleetwood Mac or something that nostalgia can kind of stir up nostalgia and make me sad and make me and think of. And he sees that I'm really trying and working at it, and I'm still a little stressed. And he sits by me, and he looks at me, and he starts to pretend that he's crying. Like, imagine Clint Eastwood, like, faking it, like, mocking me almost. And I go, what are you doing? And he goes, well, I'm just trying to loosen you up a little bit, Michael. And I looked at him, and I smiled, and I felt just so comfortable. He put me completely at ease. He wasn't stressed. His calmness kind of made me calm, and he said, listen, just let it happen naturally and, find that place. We got all day. Don't worry about anything. Don't worry about the cameras. And he just made me feel so comfortable. And then he looked and he walked away, and he looked over to me a few minutes later, and I gave him a thumbs up, and he tapped his DP, his director of photography, and he said, all right, Jack. And that was it. That meant action. Jack Green, his DP, and they started filming. And I felt like there was such an ease. Everything was peaceful and calm on the set. So you had, a lot of times these sets are chaotic and the directors are, these big personalities and they're, volatile. And there's something so innately sweet and assuring about him that I just felt confident right away.
Well, he always says he doesn't want his direction or what he's doing to impact the actors, because your preparation is going into it. He doesn't want anything he's doing to influence that. And he really sets the stage, apparently.
He does. Everything's it's simple. It's like, hey, you know how to play. He casts from tape. He cast me from tape. I auditioned, and I got a call back, and then the cast director said, hey, Clint would like you to be a little more subtle. I'm like, wait, Clint? Clint who? He's like, Clint Eastwood. Wait, Clint Eastwood saw this tape? Well, yes, he casts from tape. So,
what is that? What goes through your brain at that point? Because
I should have tried so much harder before when if I knew Clint was going to watch it. I thought Pam Sheely was watching this tape, and I didn't give a Cornell. I don't know how you go.
You've probably seen all of his westerns and Dirty Harry's and everything up to that point, so you're probably a fan too.
Oh yeah, huge fan. I mean, there's always something. Like, I'm a competitor. If you just put me in a room with a cast director, I don't really care. I mean, I'm going to try and do my best. But when you put me in a room with people that I just really admire, you put me on a football field with an NFL, you're going to try harder. You're going to just naturally work as hard as you can to try and impress, to try and get the job, to try and do whatever. And I think that's part of all of us. I mean, when I heard Clint was watching the tape, that was just the stakes went up. I had to try a little harder.
Well, you mentioned earlier, too, you'd mentioned your voiceover work. Let's talk about that. It's Comic Book Central, so let's talk a little bit about that. A lot of voiceover work for Warner Brothers DC Animation. How were you sort of introduced to that?
I moved out here, and I told my voiceover agent, Marcia Hurwitz, still my agent, voiceover agent, after 15 years, I believe.
She's doing pretty good because she's getting you a lot of work.
She's great. She's, it started out, I was like, hey, I want to do something. Get me in the animated world. How do I do that? I've done voiceovers in New York for like Magnavox or Trojan Condoms or whatever it was that made me, help pay my rent back in the day.
What was your line for a Trojan?
God, I don't. What was it? What was the Trojan? Get real. I can't remember. I can't remember what it was. I'm trying to think right now. I'll think about that. But I think it was something for Trojan. It was like a small radio spot. It gave me a couple $100 to help pay the rent.
But you knew you liked that gig.
Oh, I love. There's nothing like going in a studio in front of a microphone and just kind of like riffing and getting paid for it. And I said, Marcia, get me some animated work. And she made a call to her friend Andrea Romano. And Andrea goes, I'll make note of it. And Andrea then one day called, and Marcia called me and goes, listen, they want somebody to do a couple lines in this animated show. Can you just go in and do it? And I go, sure. And it was just lucky that I happened to be in town. And I swear to you, from that spawned a relationship with Bruce Timm, who's done a lot of the Batman and the Justice League and blah, blah, blah. You know him. And Andrea Romano. And from that, they just started calling me in. I auditioned. Right when I got Lex Luthor, I auditioned for, they go, hey, we want to audition for The Flash in the Justice League. So I went in and I auditioned and I got it. I'm like, holy crap. I'm playing The Flash. I'm playing Lex Luthor. This is ridiculous. And I was never a big comic book fan. I loved Superman the movies, and I was a big horror nut. Horror? Do you say horror or horror?
Probably depends on how scared you are.
Yeah, I guess so.
But if you're terrified, you say horror.
Horror. The horror! I'm looking at a stack of old Fangoria magazines, if it tells you.
You still have them all?
I have them all. I'm looking at... what's this one right here? This is...
Now, this will tell you whether you're a nerd or not. Are they in plastic?
Yes, most of them are.
You're a nerd.
Most of them are. I'm definitely a nerd. A lot of Fangoria magazines. A lot of toys. I'm looking at a Evil Dead Ash. I have Ash, and I have Raiders of the Lost Ark toys. And,
nice.
Anyway, I started doing all these voiceovers, and they called me in, and they said, hey... hey, do an impression here for this character, Deadshot. Can you, what about your Kevin Spacey or Christopher Walken? Or your, I would just start doing impressions, and it was just kind of like, I mean, it kind of, in a way, was like, hey, just come in here, have a couple of laughs, and we'll pay you.
And Deadshot was Kevin Spacey. You've done sort of a take on that.
Thing where he's like, listen to me, Batman. No, damn it. You listen to me, Joe. There's no swearing on your damn station. You know, he would do this whole thing where he talks like, yes, and then I just did something like that. It was just like a semblance of the character. And it's so funny because I'm friends with Kevin, and I did a couple of movies with him. And whenever I do an impression, he's like, I'll say, you know, listen to me, Kevin. I was thinking we can go to, we need to get some lunch. So why don't you pick me up at 2? And I go, why are you talking like that? And I said, I'm doing an impression of you. He goes, I don't sound like that. He got annoyed at me. Like, how dare the king of impressions, Kevin Spacey, who does everybody, how dare someone do him? And he got a little annoyed by it. I kind of laughed.
Now, the question, have you ever done Christopher Walken for Christopher Walken?
Yeah, I did a movie called Pool Hall Junkies. And, I mean, it was a really fun movie, and it just, you know, didn't do as well as I think it should have, because I thought it was a great cast, and really, it was a really fun movie. But on set, you know, I really got to know the real Walken, because everybody would do this, like, a parody, or they would do this kind of impression that they heard, and it kind of became this...
Everybody kind of does the Saturday Night Live thing.
Yeah, it was like, you know, everybody would go, wow, I don't know, and it was stupid. It was like, that's not how he sounds.
Right.
He doesn't sound like that. He's really subtle. He actually, when he's talking, he'll, you know, he'll say, well, I'll give you an example. He says, you know, I remember, you know, going up to him and going, hey, Christopher Walken, should I call you Chris? Should I call you Mr. Walken? He goes, I don't know. He said, call me Flash. And I said, he did. He said, call me Flash. This is way before I even got Flash. So I don't know what it meant. And the next day on set, I kind of, you know, I was with my friend Anson Mount, who is now on that show, Hell on Wheels. And I said, Anson, dude, I'm already in with Walken. We already have a thing. I call him Flash. I go, watch this. I go, hey, Flash. And I must have said Flash 4 times. He never turned around. He never turned around. He looks at me and goes, what? What is he talking about? I don't know, understand what he's talking about. Like, he just completely threw me under the bus. And I knew he did it purposely. But he's an odd guy. He's one of those guys who, when he's frustrated, and he, look, rightfully so, he's doing an independent movie, Pool Hall Junkies. You know, the day's long. And, you know, he's an older guy, and he's, like, been doing every movie from... I mean, he's done everything, and he just goes to the director. He said, Maz, because the director's name is Mars, and he says, Maz, today's my last day. That's it. And, of course, it wasn't his last day. He had, like, a week left. But he was so frustrated. He's like, Maz, today's my last day. But he didn't mean it.
Yeah.
And we had Rod Steiger and Chaz Palminteri and all these greats, and it was just, I mean, talk about a life-changing experience. I mean...
Do you think Walken's doing that? Do you think he's doing it as an act, or is that him?
No, I think, you know, that's, look, you don't, I don't think he start out doing, you know, something like that. I think that's real. I think that's who he is. He's just an odd, you know, he's an odd guy. But then I think he started to embrace it. He was like, wow, people are doing impressions of me. You know, I'm getting more work. This is what they want. So I think there comes a time when you kind of, it's like it's your personality, but you add a little something to it because you want it. You know what I mean? Like that De Niro. I'm sure De Niro gives you a little bit more of the, I don't know. You're telling me? You know, I'm sure
it's become exaggerated over the years.
Yeah, you exaggerated it because you think it's what people want. And then I think eventually you go back into what, you know, works naturally.
So you're saying Walken is profiting from his eccentricity now?
He might. I mean, I would Flash. If somebody's like, hey, do the Michael Rosenbaum. Like, I don't really know what that is, man. I don't think that's going to happen. I don't think I do.
Well, you channeled Christopher Walken with Ghoul.
That's right. The Ghoul on Batman, right? Batman Beyond?
Justice League Unlimited.
Unlimited, right. That's right.
Well, let's run them down. You have Batman Beyond, Batman Beyond Return of the Joker, Batman Brave and the Bold, Static Shock, Zeta Project, Justice League Unlimited, Justice League Doom, Teen Titans, even a video game, Infinite Crisis.
I did a couple of video games, and you know what? I just booked a video game today, and nice. I'm not allowed to talk about it. I had to sign off on it.
Is it a comic book related? Or
I could say that I can't really say, but let's just say it's a lot of fun, and it's... I get to really push the envelope a little bit. I guess it'll be show some depth, and it's fun. I like those things. You go in for a couple hours and scream and cry and yell, but it's lead character, so I'm looking forward to it. Very I'll cool. let you know, Joe, when I can talk about it.
Absolutely. When you go in, you like to do a lot of improv. Do you get to mm-hmm. do that in voiceover, or do you pretty much have to stick to what's there?
You know, most of the time when you're working with somebody else, that they want you to do a specific thing. So you just kind of come in. I always have ideas, and I always have things that if I feel like they're open to it, I'll suggest. But if not, I'll say, they're not going to go for this. They want me to stick to the writing, and I'll do that. But I always have something else. I like to improvise. I like things to be a little loose, especially the on set. You know, the movie I just directed, I felt like, listen, let's get it the way it's written, and then I want you guys to have fun. And I think that's the best way to do it. I think when an actor knows that he has a little freedom, there's a calmness to him. There's like, okay, cool. We don't have to take things as seriously. We can get the job done and still have fun. And I think a lot of times you have to go in there and you have to read the lines, and the director is the writer and wants you to say the line exactly the right way, and you know, that kind of thing. So it's, you know, I like to have fun.
You mentioned Andrea Romano. So when you're doing this work for Warner Brothers, what kind of direction are you getting? Or do you ever hit a point where she's saying, different, but like you're not sure how different, so you got to kind of make it up a little bit?
You know, I am one, and a lot of actors do not want to hear the word line reads. Don't tell me how to say it. I think that's just a bunch of crap. Tell me what you want. You're the director. Tell me what you want. If I'm not getting it, how do you want me to say it? Just say it. Let's not waste any more time. And unless I completely hate the way she said it or he said it, then I. So a lot of times, you know, I wouldn't say a lot, but usually you're reading a line, and I like my style for voiceover is just do three in a row. You know, if I say, I really hate you, Joe, but that's the line. You know, it'd be something like, I really hate you, Joe. Michael, can you do it a little bit friendlier? I really hate you, Joe. Michael, can you make it a little more intense? I really hate you, Joe. You know, and then she's like, I'm like, no, that's not exactly what, well, Andrea, what are you looking for? I really hate you, Joe. Thank you, and I'll do it exactly like she just read it. If I like it. I have no ego when it comes to that. I just want to get the job done. So,
do you get to watch these finished projects as a fan? I mean, do you watch Justice League Doom? Or Batman Beyond?
I'd like to. I haven't had time to watch everything. I've probably only seen about 40%, 30% of the, probably 40% of the Smallvilles. I watched the first two seasons, and then I watched a couple here and there, and then I watched towards the end. But, in fact, I was just making this joke. I hate to watch with my friends. I'm really uncomfortable, like really uncomfortable. I always feel like I'm being judged, always. I've always had that.
It's an interesting take on. Well, let's talk about Smallville. 7 out of the 10 seasons, you were starring in it. At the time, the WB was a fledgling network. You were on a show on the WB. You kind of were there at the beginning doing comedy. Is that how you got attention or got noticed for Smallville?
These are good questions, Joe. No one asked me these questions. You know, I had just done this movie, Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, and it was like it was a small part. It was such a small part in Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil that I wasn't even invited to the premiere, and I had this big scene, and I actually snuck in, and I went by myself. That's true. And then I went back home to New York, and I was living in a one-bedroom with four guys, and I got a call for an audition. And I went and auditioned, and then they say, hey, they want you to test screen. And it was called The Tom Show with Tom Arnold for the WB, and I had no idea what this meant. So I flew to L.A., didn't sleep all night, went in there assuming there's, you know, what does this mean? There's eight other guys in the room that look way more handsome than I do. I got this long hair. I got this, two roses on my shirt. It's this button down. I got this hairy chest. I'm like, I'm not getting this role. Look at these kids. And next thing you know, somehow I got the role. It's a pretty funny story. In brief, I walked in and Tom Arnold was there, and he's like, hey, buddy, would you do anything for the show? I'm like, yes, I would. He's like, would you shave your chest, buddy? I'm like, I'd shave your initials in it. Whatever you want, man. And we just hit it off, and I went outside, and I heard, I was on the phone with my agent. My agent goes, how'd you do? And I turned around because I heard a whistle, and Tom Arnold gives me this thumbs up and nods. He's like, you got the part. And I said, I think I just got the part. He's like, you don't know that. We haven't got a call. I go, trust me, I think I just got the part. Nice. And that landed me in L.A. So now in L.A., I went from The Tom Show, which lasted a year. Then I got this other show called Zoe Duncan, Jack and Jane, which then became Zoe. It was with Selma Blair and David Moscow, who's the kid from Big, who's a great guy. And then I went on to do a pilot for them. I was pretty much the WB, poster child. And, it was all comedy. And then they were doing the show Smallville, and they said, hey, they're doing this show Smallville. It's Superman when they're young. And I'm like, it sounds corny as shit. No thanks. I want to do something else.
What was your perception? Tights flying around, like the Superboy TV show?
Yeah, like, I don't know, Lois and Clark. Is it going to be campy? Is it going to be not take itself too seriously? I wanted something with a little more depth or something that really good writing. They had no script. They had no script that they were giving to people to read. So, unfortunately, it was just they gave us three pieces of paper with the scene between Lex and Clark where I'm fencing, and then I tell him, we have our first little talk in the castle. And they kept coming to me, and they said, listen, we've auditioned 700 guys, and none of them are doing it. And I go, well, how do you audition 700 actors, and none of them are doing it? What are they doing wrong? And so I've told the story a lot of times, but they say, listen, we want a sense of danger, charisma, and comedic timing. Can you do that? I wasn't really sold on the project, but I was like, okay, you know what? I had nothing to lose. I had no fear. It was one of those things where I didn't care if I got it. And I went in and I circled this page, I'll be funny. This page, I'll be dangerous. This page, I'll be charismatic. And I went in, and it was just the casting director. And she taped it. And I came back, and my agent goes, they really liked you. They want you to test screen for it. I'm like, nah, I'm not going to do better than what I did. Just tell them to rewind the tape. And it wasn't being a jerk. It was just like, I can't do better than that. I'm not going in again. And they made me an offer. And then I went and met with Alan Miles, the creators, and I just felt like they brought such a, I don't know, there's a certain air of respect and of credibility, and I felt safe. I felt, this is going to be a good show. This, they're not going to let me look stupid. They're not going to be up, and there's going to be no tights. There's a whole thing where it says no tights, no flights, or whatever. And, they were going to ground the story and make it real and about friendship and about how, unfortunately, even these two destinies, the arc of each destiny. And so to me, I just felt like it felt right. And I had no idea it was going to be the hit it was. I mean,
did you get a sense at that point meeting with the creators that this was going to be more of a character driven piece rather than a special effects kind of extravaganza?
Yeah, when they started talking about my character and how troubled he was and how, his relationship with his father and all the subtext, and I was like, wow, this is, are you sure this is WB? Are you sure you guys are going to do this? Because
I'm
the
comedy
really
guy.
Today, it's just like, they hadn't pushed the envelope, and I think Smallville was the first time where even the meteor shower and the pilot was a little bit, like, disturbing. It's like this little girl loses her parents, and a giant, rock falls on them and kills them. And I was like, okay, this is a little dark. I like a little dark. I like a little, it was a little spice. I think, honestly, it's the best thing that they'd ever done. Obviously, it went to the CW, but I was definitely proud of the show, and I was happy they went in that direction. I mean, you never know. It's always a crapshoot, and I definitely think we got lucky.
Obviously, taking the role of Lex Luthor, you got to think bald. Did you ever think about doing what John Shea did and saying, "Hey, this is the '90s"? Do you think a billionaire like Luthor couldn't get himself a full head of hair? Which is how he played it in Lois and Clark.
There's got to be somewhere a top 10 list of Michael Rosenbaum's ideas emailed to the creator saying, "I got an idea. Lex will have hair this year. He'll have hair. He'll try on different wigs. Maybe there's I had all these ideas that I was going to have and they're like, "No, you're shaving your head." And I had no idea what I was in for. I mean, I couldn't be more grateful. I couldn't be, I'm so glad I did it. But I never knew that I had to shave my head every day. It wasn't like it was once a week. It was every day. And it wasn't even shaving the head, but they had to put like 3 layers of makeup so I didn't have a hairline. So the first 2 seasons were 2 hours before anybody else came to set that I was in the makeup chair. So it was like a prosthetic. It was brutal. Brutal.
Did you ever, at the end of a season when you would take a break, did you ever wonder, how's it going to grow back? Is it going to be what I
wondered?
It
was like, I'll tell you what, the Lord was on my side because it did grow back, and thank God I still have it. I didn't know what was going to happen. I was like, am I going to be bald for real? Am I, how many times can this makeup artist cut my head open with a razor?
Sutures were involved?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes there's just blood trickling down my head. I wouldn't even feel it. She's like, "I'm sorry." I'm like, "It's okay, Natalie. I'm numb to it now. Why don't you try my neck next time? Go for the jugular."
Tape it up and play hurt. Hey, actors often say when they get the part of the villain that you can't play the villain as a villain. Is that how you saw it?
Yep. You can't. If I played him as a villain, then the series would have been over, or it would have been really cheesy, and it would have been, no one would have taken my character seriously. There was many times where I was like, "Guys, this is too serious. Like, should not be this serious. Should not be this mean or angry. He's, let's ease into this." But they had a really good idea what they wanted. And we had 6-7 years. That's another thing. By the time I was like, okay, this show's going to last 5 years. We'll do 5 years and get out. And it'll be great because it'll be so tight, and by then I'll come out. And I don't know how they went 10 years. I just don't know how they did it. Obviously, I think the Alan Miles are fantastic creators, and I think they had a great team behind them. But it's always about money. It always comes down to, the studio wants to make money. The network wants to make money, so the episodes must go on. And I think the fans wanted them to go on, too. But the story, you wonder why story sometimes is sacrificed, is because how do you do 22 episodes a year for 10 years? You're going to have some bad episodes. And
you can't get them to Superman. You can't get them to that point, so you've got to keep fighting that.
Right, exactly. And, I get, with me, it was with Lex, you have those moments where you're like, "Oh, this is a turning point. This is..." Now, the great thing about it is you got to understand why I became the villain. So you got to see the story with how my mother died, my younger brother, Julian, and all these other things. And you got to go into my head, get into my head, which is, you don't get to do that in a movie too much. But in a series, you have some time, and they did explore it, and you got to see the relationship with my father and his past and my past and how it all comes together, and how you are a product of your own environment and how the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. And so I really commend them for the arc that, you know, Lex had. I think it was a great arc.
Did you ever get to have conversations between scenes with Tom Welling or with John Glover about how are we going to handle this? What's the motivation here? How are we going to handle this intense scene? Did you ever kind of work with the other actors?
Oh, yeah. You know, and Tom hadn't done a whole lot, like, in the first when the show first got on. So, you know, we worked together, and, you know, we wanted to help each other out. I made a joke. I said, listen, man, if we're going to make it on this show and it's going to be a big success, there's only room for one ego, and that's me. We both laughed. And, you know, from then on, I think we had one little tat that lasted 2 seconds. We never fought. We got along. You know, Tom was he was a good leader, and we got along really well. And I think the great thing was we really got a kick out of each other. I made him laugh every day. And, you know, if you have egos and sometimes you don't want to collaborate, you don't want to work together, you think you know everything. And I'm always one to just try and make things better. And, you know, if a scene wasn't working, I'd say to the director, let's take five. Let's figure it out. And so would Tom. Tom would say, this isn't working, man. I feel stupid. And then we'd talk about it and we'd get it right and we'd make it work.
Season 6, you got your first chance to direct an episode. The episode was titled Freak. I saw that you'd mentioned one time the toughest part for you as a director was directing a certain actor named Michael Rosenbaum.
Yeah, really difficult.
A challenge, a diva?
Yeah. you know what? I actually...
How do you do that? How do you jump out of one and into another and then act and direct?
It's really hard. I'll tell you why it's hard. It's hard because when you're doing TV, you're filming an episode, and then you're prepping for the next episode that you're also in. And then as you're in that, there's another episode that's overlapping your episode. So you're doing three episodes. You're trying to sleep. You've got to, you know, and all of a sudden, you know, you're in a scene and you're like, okay, you know, how do I do this? And it was a balancing act. And it's like, you know, you have to have faith in the script supervisor or the AD and just go, hey, are we good, guys? I felt it. And they're like, yeah. And you just have faith in your team. And, you know, I thought I learned from that, where it's like, I'm not going to direct anything that I'm in, but that didn't stop me. So I ended up doing, you know, my movie, which was, it's when you're directing yourself, it's, you never want to give yourself as much time as you do with the other actors. You always want to make the actors feel like, you know, your ego, you know, you're grounded, you know, and that comes with preparation. It's just like, I knew my lines, I knew what I was going to do, and I didn't need many takes. I knew the character, so that really helped. And I wanted to show the actors that I'm there for them, and I'm not so narcissistic or egotistical as to, you know, just take care of myself and give myself take after take after take. I get their performances, and then I get mine. And, you know, that's how I did it. And I think that's how, you know, it's a balancing act.
Meryl Streep once mentioned when she was shooting with Clint Eastwood, Bridges of Madison County, that they were at a table scene, and she actually caught him thinking as a director instead of the actor. And she mentioned it to him, and he said, it'll never happen again. Did you find yourself at all doing that in a scene with, say, Kristen Crook or something, where you're more director than actor and you had to jump out of that?
There are moments where I caught it myself, where I'm talking to someone and I could see the camera moving. And instead of just going with it and just make, I can't pretend, I have to say stop. Or go back, guys, I'm not in the moment. My head's not there. And that would happen occasionally, and I think that still happens either as an actor or an actor-director. It's like, you know, I know when something's not real, and when you're thinking about something else, you really got to snap out of it. But there was, with comedy, it was easier for me. I mean, I was almost in every scene in the movie that I just directed, and you had to be on your feet. Go back, camera, go back. When I say this line, start moving the camera forward. I want you to stop by the time she says this. Marina, take the line where you say back, blah, blah, you know, and then, so you just kind of, you wing it in a lot of ways. You know where the camera is, you know what you want, you know the performance, and you just have to just, you know, fake it sometimes, you know?
Allison Mack was a little vulnerable in that episode. Were those scenes tough to direct?
I loved it. That was my favorite part, was that she had to be so emotional, and she had to trust me. And I said to her, listen to me. You are going to look great if you listen to me. that's how much confidence I had. I said, listen, if you just trust me and don't worry about anything else, you're going to be great in this episode. And she nodded, and she said, okay. And there was a scene where she had to cry, and I go, I want you to tear up towards the end of the episode. And she, the cameras are rolling, and she goes, she says, Michael, can you come here for a second? I said, sure. She goes, can you tell me that story about your grandma again? And I said, sure. And I started to tell her the story about my grandmother and how much I loved her. And I saw these tears start to well. And I said, okay, let's roll. And she was ready. And it was really emotional. It was really, really good. And she channeled that. And again, that's, I learned from people like Clint Eastwood, who it's safety. It's calm. It's just the actors trusting you. You want them to trust you. You want them to know that. And now it's like you'd never even hesitate. If Clint asked you to do something, you'd do it. You know, so hopefully one day I get to the point where, you know, like I said, I've only directed a couple of things. This, a short that I directed called Fade Into You, and then the movie Back in the Day. And I think at the end, every actor, at the end, they when they watched their performance, they realized he did take care of me. Because I felt like the performances were all there, and I wasn't going to sacrifice that. And everybody had their performances, and the timing was there, and they were all really good. I think that's the goal. I think that should be the goal for everybody, for every director, is to make sure your actors are protected. They're vulnerable. They're giving you themselves. They're, you know, and you have to take care of them. You have to have a vision. You have to know what you want, and I think that's really important.
If they had said, we're going to end it with season 8, we promise, this is it, it's going to be a final, would you have done that last season?
It would have been a conversation. It would have been a conversation. But at that time, I really knew that I wanted to go and do comedy. And I knew that I had to start over. A lot of people don't understand that. You know, some people say, well, what is he going to do if he's not going to do Smallville? It's like, well, I'm actually doing a ton of stuff. And you don't just come back and say, okay, put me in a movie, put me on here. You actually have to grow your hair out for like 3 or 4, like 4 or 5 months. You actually have to go to casting directors and revisit them and meet new ones and say, hey, here, I'm Michael Rosenbaum. I'm actually, I'm a comedian. I'm an actor. I do these things. I've been gone for 7 years doing a show. So you have to establish yourself again. And so it's meetings and it's, then a pilot that didn't go, and then a Fox series breaking in for 10 episodes, and then it's a movie, Hit and Run, and it's slowly, but, you know, it's like you really have to, and every year I felt like I was wasting too much time. I had done enough, and so that was really the basis for why I left. I felt I want to go direct a movie. I want to create. I want to start a production company. I want to do TV. I want to be, I want to do my own thing. I want to spend time with my family. Again, and it wasn't like they threw a deal that was just like, something I couldn't resist. It was, it was just, hey, do another year. Well, I don't know if I want to. So, I mean, just to get a little personal, that's kind of where my mind was. I when you do 10 months a year in Vancouver, Canada, and you're away from your house and your family and your dog and you're like, okay, well, what else do I have to do? I think I've done it all. I was never late to work. I showed up. I hit my mark. I said my lines. I sent fan mail back to my fans. I think I did my job. So ultimately, I felt like my job was complete. Like my work was done, you know?
And you made the fans deliriously happy by coming back for the last episode. So we did get an exclamation point.
Well, that was absolutely for you guys. That was absolutely for the fans. I mean, you know, I didn't want to hear, why didn't you go back? Why didn't you come back? I felt like it was I needed to go back for that final episode, and I felt like it was the final piece of the puzzle, and going back was emotional, and it was great. Now, what's crazy is it's 10 years. How many years is it after? We started in 02. This show's got to be started 12 years ago, right?
Right.
Think about that. 12 years ago, and I will be going to Dallas to sign autographs at the Dallas Con. 12 years later, the fans still want to see you. I think Smallville fans are the best. Superman fans across the board are just, I mean, talk about loyalty. I mean, it's crazy. What other show on TV can you, there's not a ton, that after 12 years since the show's since the show first started. I mean, that you know, they're still cheering you on, they're still supporting you, and it's pretty fascinating.
Well, it's a testament to the actors that were in it. You mentioned some of the latest projects you have. One of the ones I thought was interesting, Saved by Zeros. What was that?
Yes. Well, it's funny you say that because we're in negotiations right now. We're trying. You know, I had originally sold the show to Sony and Sci-Fi. And,
this is you and Jonathan Silverman.
Yeah, I wrote it and created it, and I was originally it was Jonathan Silverman was going to play the captain of this ship, and I was going to play like his one of his like you know the Scotty from Star Trek character. And I know I asked him to you know if he'd consider being the captain. So this was a couple of years ago, and so Sci-Fi bought it, and then we developed it, and ultimately they had three shows. And they had to pick two of the three, and it got up, sent up the chain to the head. And I remember the president of Sci-Fi loved the show and said, I want this one. But ultimately, they went with the other two out of three, and our invitation got lost in the mail. And a year and a half passed, and I was like, you know, this is my goal. This is my dream. This is my passion. I've got to make the show. So I kept pushing it. And then I got a call from Universal. And they're interested in doing it, and so now this whole negotiation, we're trying to make it work. Let's just say the stage that it's in now is we're trying to make it happen. And this is kind of like a
Galaxy Quest-ish.
Galaxy Quest meets Eastbound and Down. It's quirky. It's dark. It's funny. It's got emotion. It's real at its core.
These two actors were on a hit sci-fi
show.
I
wouldn't say a hit show, but a sci-fi show that did well, but it didn't last very long. And they weren't the best of friends, but it got canceled, but it became a cult favorite. As you know, there's a lot of cult shows that, you know, the fans just embrace. And so it's something like that, and now all they have left, they live in this small house in Burbank, California, and they go to all they have left of their fans at their conventions. And so it's really a fun show. It's sweet. It makes fun of, you know, everything. My goal in life is to make fun of everybody. I'm a Jew. I tell Jew jokes, okay? Make fun of everybody. Make light of everything. And, you know,
you would have been great in the 70s.
Oh, yeah, right? Well, you know what? This show is just fun, and it makes fun. You know, the characters, they make fun of themselves, and you make fun of everybody, and it's edgy, and I'm really looking forward to making this. So we'll find out really soon if that's going to happen. If not, there's another thing I'm working on with that, another little series, and so yeah, I'm excited about that.
Michael Rosenbaum, yeah, trying to end political correctness. I hope we get to see it sometime soon. You mentioned another project that you're working on.
Isn't it too much, though, is political correctness? You never know what to say anymore now. You feel like, oh, is that what I'm supposed to? It changes every decade. My grandfather said this. I don't know what to say anymore. So now you don't say anything. Like, I don't know. It just gets everybody so uptight.
I'm obsessed with old Match Game episodes, and it blows my mind with what used to happen. It's amazing. But hey, maybe you can do a little something about that. Hopefully we'll see that project.
Well, I just think everybody should just kind of, you know, hit their pants and dive in, huh? Just relax a little bit. Everything's going to be fine.
That's not the title of your new project, is it?
Yeah, I think that should be my new project.
That'll be the next.
Hit your pants and dive in.
Start the screenplay. But your current project is a movie called Back in the Day. You are, as we mentioned, actor, director, writer, executive producer. You're in pre-production on this?
I am. We're almost done. It's called Back in the Day. It stars myself, Marina Baccarin, who just was nominated for an Emmy for Homeland, and Nick Swartzen, who's hysterical, a lot of the Sandler comedies, and Harlan Williams, Dumb and Dumber, Something About Mary, Sarah Colonna from Chelsea Lately. She also has a book on the best-selling list, New York Times. Isaiah Mustafa, the old Spice guy who's in Horrible Bosses. Liz Carey, Jay Ferguson from Mad Men. Who else? Who else do we have?
How'd
we
you
have
get
so
everybody?
People.
My goodness. What'd you do? Hit the Rolodex and
I mean, you know what?
Call in a few favors?
Who else? Danielle Bassuti, who was the evil mother in Insidious 2. Yeah, it's just
it's
Emma Caulfield, who's from Buffy. So it's Chris Paloha. Yeah, it's a great cast. It's funny. We shot in my hometown of Newburgh in Evansville, Indiana. And I mean, I shut up my old high school, my sister's house, my mom's house. You know, it was one of these little million-dollar movies. And talk about, like, your dream come true. It's like not only directing a movie, but in your hometown.
What was that like?
It's amazing. I mean, everybody was supportive, and, you know, we couldn't afford these big, the biggest crews, so, you know, we had to hire some locals, and we got a lot of help, and we got a lot of publicity, and we're going to go and give them a screening in January, and it was a real pleasure. I'm very lucky. I pinch myself every day. But
When can we expect to see it?
I would say you're going to see it in theaters towards the end of January, February. You'll see it on video on demand and all that stuff. And so, you know, be looking for it January, February.
What's it about?
It's really about a guy who, you know, went off, left this small town and went out to be an actor in Hollywood. Now he's kind of the face of like an insurance company, you know, this commercial that's kind of nationwide, and he's kind of got his tail between his legs, and he's invited back to his reunion, and he goes back home, and he falls in love with this town that he ran away from so many years ago, and, you know, takes his humdrum friends around, gets them in trouble with their wives. They see, you know, seek vengeance on their old high school principal. Kind of like a Porky's throwback, you know, fun reunion date raunchy comedy. I mean, it's like, you know, old Sandler mixed in with a little John Hughes. A lot of fun. There's some really big set pieces and some big laughs, and I don't know what else to say other than it's you know, that we tested it and it tested great, and now we're gonna release it, and so yeah, you'll have to promote the heck out of it. Back in the day,
what do you like better, acting or directing?
You know, it's so weird. I was gonna just act my whole life, and then about halfway through Smallville, I started to write. And I started to write some stuff, and my friend Gary Fisher goes, "Did this really happen to you, all these things I'm reading that I wrote about?" And I'm like, "Yeah." She goes, you should write this stuff. You should do this. This is funny." So I teamed up with Greg Beeman, who's directing the Spielberg series up north, and he was also director of a lot of episodes on Smallville and EP. And we wrote a TV show and sold it, and then we wrote a movie, and I just started writing. And then years later, I ended up doing this, and ultimately, I didn't know I was going to be a writer. Then I started really liking to write, and believe it or not, then I was like, you know what? I want to direct. Now I'm learning all these things. I mean, doing this movie was a crash course in filmmaking. I mean, from, you know, pre-production and casting and scout locations to and budgets and then to directing or photo boarding and directing and then post with editing and sound and color and the titles and. Now selling the movie, it's been a year and a half of just constant education. So I don't know what the future holds, but I'll tell you, if I could control it, I would say I'd love to continue acting, directing, and writing. Absolutely, I'd love to do it all, because to tell you the truth, I like a little bit of control. If I could just direct stuff for the rest of my life, I think I'd have a great time.
You directed the lovely Marina Baccarin in this. Should she be cast as Wonder Woman?
Heck yeah. Have you seen her? Have you seen her body, her face, her complexion? Yes. I don't know why not.
She's your choice?
Mm-hmm. She's a phenomenal woman. I'm not just saying that because she's in the movie. She is a treat to work with. So professional. And, you know, she plays such a serious role in Homeland. And now in my movie, she's so funny. And she's outgoing. And she's playful. And she's sexy, and she's all these things, so I can't wait till people see the other side of her, and I think they're going to be wowed. So
I can't wait to see it. Hey, you also mentioned recently that, and this was before the Star Wars Origin movies were announced, but you had mentioned that you might like to play Han Solo. Any chance we'll see you in one of these? They're talking about the Han Solo Origin movie.
I would love it. I would love it. Again, I don't
have any
conversations. But I'm always, I'd love my phone to ring and they'd say, "Hey, you're going to do this." It's always, I don't know if it's a pipe dream, but.
No conversations regarding that at all, though?
Yeah, I mean, there's only so much you could do. You could tell your agent and they can kind of send the message, but, you know, it's like.
You have done that then?
I don't know if I've done that. I mean, I always say that, look, I'd love to have played Han Solo. That's the one role I would have. that would have been the role to play for me. For me as an actor, I mean, that would have been the best role. I think, you know, I just loved how he played it, Harrison Ford. I mean, you can't really beat Harrison Ford, but I mean, that's the kind of character that I'd love to play. So who knows? Who knows? Maybe there's something out there similar, or the new kind of Star Wars that has a character just like that.
There's a Han Solo origin movie coming out, so let's keep a good thought for it.
Spread the word, man. Get me an audition, will you? Don't you have any pull,
wow,
Joe?
I'll talk to your agent.
Yeah.
You are quickly becoming a favorite son of the organizers of the Superman celebration in Metropolis, Illinois. You mentioned going back to your hometown to shoot. You're beloved there, obviously. What's it like to be treated like royalty by the town of Metropolis, Illinois?
Let me tell you something. I mean, those people are just phenomenal. I grew up in a small town in Indiana. And, you know, felt like growing up again. And I don't even think of myself. I remember there's this guy there who was driving me around. His name's Kevin. And, you know, and his wife, they were just volunteers. And I just remember going out, you know, eating breadsticks with him and driving around and having a drink. And I was like, you know, those people in Metropolis are just really down-to-earth people who like to have a good time. And the event, the Metropolis event, the Superman celebration is a big thing for them. And I love how they could just embrace it and have fun. And it's their thing. They own it. And having me there was just, I mean, it's a treat. You go there for like 2 days and they've got a new casino and you gamble a little bit and you have some drinks and some fun. And it's a real treat.
There's like a prom there? So there's like a Smallville
prom?
Yeah,
they did a prom. I showed up.
You crashed it?
I crashed.
You crashed the prom?
They're like, I can't believe you came. I can't believe you showed up. But I think there's a stigma attached to that. You know, these actors, I think they're just like too cool for school. They can't. I'm the kind of nerd that was like, I was never invited to my prom. I never went to a school dance. So I'm like, what? You're having a dance? Well, I'm freaking there. I'm coming. You know, so.
You showed up. Yeah, there's pictures of you just like popping in.
For a few minutes. You know, it only makes a couple people smile. What's wrong with making someone smile, right?
Well, you mentioned that there was some. So I had a chance to go a few years ago, and I hope you don't mind me telling the story. I hope I don't embarrass you on any level. But in Metropolis, Illinois, I remember before they started doing the tickets for the autographs, because it's become so massive now that they've got it to a system now where you can get tickets and go in and everybody gets autographs. But the first time you were there, you and Stefan Bender of Superman Returns, he played the young Clark, were there, and the lines just went block after block after block. And I know you had to leave at one point, and there was no way that everybody in line was going to get an autograph. And you and Stefan came out and just walked the line the whole way through and made sure that everybody got an autograph. Because if they had to wait, there's no way they would have. You guys
had
it.
You remember that? You heard about that?
I do. I was there. And I tell you, one thing that stuck with me was, because you guys were flying through the line because you had to get through. I mean, the amount of people was just insane. But there was one of your fans was there, a young man in a wheelchair. And I remember as quickly as you were going through the line, you stopped and just talked to this guy for, you know, you shared some moments with him. And I thought that was amazing. You know, as quickly as you, the two of you were going through the line, you took some time to stop and chat with this fan. My wife and I were both there, and we thought that was amazing. Because we kind of look at celebrities sometimes and become jaded, and you talked about egos and things before, but that kind of stuck with us, that you were able to do that. So, yeah, it's no surprise you're Metropolis' favorite son.
Well, you know what, that means a lot to me, and I guess the way I was brought up, that's all I know. I just don't know any other way. It just doesn't make sense to me that, you know, sitting there and people that have paid for tickets and are waiting in a huge line, why anybody would not do their best to make sure everybody got, you know, a signature or whatever. And how lucky are we to have people waiting around that want our signature or want to meet us? So I felt like, okay, well, what do we have to do? What are the options? Well, Michael, you have to go catch a plane. Well, I'm going to walk outside. And it just seemed right to me. It just seemed like this is the way to do it. And I think, you know, we take for granted the fact that we inadvertently change lives. You know, being an actor and, you know, someone who watches Smallville, it's amazing. I've talked about this, but you know, I've had soldiers say, hey, we were in Iraq, and this is all we watched with Smallville, and this, like, this really got us through it. And it's just, I'm like, what? The impact that you have, that you don't even know you have, what you're doing for people by just getting paid to say some lines and be a part of something is tremendous. And so, you know, to me, to make someone smile, to make someone, you know, you never want someone to, I just want everybody's memory, you know, of me to be something that was pleasant. You know, if they meet you, it's pleasant. I think a lot of people are like, they don't have time. My whole rule is I'll never turn a kid away, no matter what. I don't turn a kid away. You know, I mean, certainly sometimes you're having a dinner and you get a mouthful of spaghetti and someone's like, can I get a picture? And I'm like, holy crap. You just scared the life out of me. Can you wait till I'm done eating? But for the most part, I don't think there's I'm pretty easy going. I'm going to stop for most people. And I think it's just, I just never knew any other way. So, but you remember that. That's crazy. I remember that day. I remember there was just like hundreds of people. And it was hot. And I was like, what are you guys doing? You don't need my autograph. What the hell?
Middle of summer. Yeah, it was brutal, the temperatures out there. But you guys worked the line, and it was amazing, both you and Stefan. It was great. How can fans find out more about you? Website, Facebook, what do we got?
Yes, you know what? I appreciate that. You know what? They could follow me on Twitter, and that is mrosenbaum711. And then they can go to Facebook, or actually also on Twitter, is Back in the Day the Movie. It's just the letters Back in the Day, so BITD the Movie is the Twitter handle. So definitely follow us on at BITD the Movie and at mrosenbaum711. And then on Facebook, it's you can go to Back in the Day the Movie and Michael Rosen. There's 100 people, I guess, posing as me, but there's one as for Back in the Day, and then there's one as the director. So follow me on Facebook, and you know, and keep an eye out for Back in the Day. You know, I think, you know, the only thing I could ever ask for is if you get such great fans and you know, go to these conventions, I'm just saying, hey, if you really like me, go support the movie. So,
well, we'll follow you on Twitter. I'm sure we'll get some updates on that. I'm sure when the first trailer comes out, that'll be you'll post that as well.
Yeah, and I'll send you stuff and follow me. And yeah, this was a real treat. Yeah, it was a nice conversation. You asked me some questions that I don't normally hear, so. Put me on the spot, Joe.
that's what we do. But, well, you know, you're Lex Luthor. You know, you kept us on our toes. We're going to keep you on yours.
Yeah, you can keep me on my toes.
And hey, that day in Metropolis really stuck out in my mind. So, you know what? Even though you're known for playing one of the bad guys, you are definitely one of the good guys, Michael Rosenbaum. Appreciate you being on the show today.
Joe, thanks so much for having me. And make sure you listen to this guy's show. He sounds like a good guy. People should listen to you, damn it, Joe. And take care. Thanks for listening today. I hope you had a good time. I did.
My thanks to Michael Rosenbaum for hanging out with me in the lair. And as you heard in the interview, Michael said to expect some news about his new movie, Back in the Day. Well, I have that information right here. Back in the Day comes out January 7th on video on demand and January 17th worldwide. For more information on the flick, check it out on Twitter at BITD the Movie and Facebook Back in the Day Movie. And if you're anywhere near Chicago, Louisville, St. Louis, or San Antonio, Michael's going to be making some personal appearances from March through June. And he'll even be in Australia. Hey, Lex Luthor always did like Australia, right? Go see him, say hi, tell him you loved his interview on Comic Book Central. And speaking about Comic Book Central, you can check out our website, comicbookcentral.net. Give it a like on Facebook at facebook.com/comicbookcentralnetwork. Retweet it on Twitter at comicbookctrl, and subscribe to the show on iTunes and post a review if you wouldn't mind. And you can drop me a line at joe@comicbookcentral.net. And hey, while you're at it, be sure to show some love for a couple of other great podcasts. MonsterKidRadio.net, where host Derek Cook takes you back in time to relive the horror classics from yesteryear. He's got an awesome breakdown of these frightening flicks, and he's got some cool guests as well. If you're a fan of Mystery Science Theater 3000, you know one of the best, worst films they've ripped on is Manos, The Hands of Fate. Well, Derek recently interviewed one of the actresses from that notorious film. It's a pretty fun ride. And I'm going to be joining Derek once again for the next Abbott and Costello Scarefest. Abbott and Costello meet the killer Boris Karloff. Ooh, it's scary stuff, kids. Check it out, monsterkidradio.net. And, of course, Keith Voss and I join Ed Dalasta and the rest of the IndieCast crew every 2 weeks over at theindiecast.com. Just celebrated the 6th anniversary of the show with a roundtable discussion of our favorite archaeologists. So let the Raiders Redline direct you to theindiecast.com. Well, the final page is turned on this edition, but don't despair. Comic Book Central will be back with more podcasty goodness in 2 weeks. The celebration of Superman continues with, oh, boys and girls, you are not going to want to miss this one. The producer of the original Superman film franchise, Ilya Salkind, will be here. This man set the wheels in motion so we could all believe a man can fly. It's going to be a good one. Until then, keep watching those comic book movies and TV shows, play those video games, and join me back here in the lair, Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. This podcast is intended for entertainment and education purposes only. All original content in this podcast is the intellectual property of Comic Book Central and is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivations 3.0 Unported License. All other content and names are registered trademarks and copyrights of their respective holders.
Hey, why not?